Some people claim that the atrocities we commit in our fiction are those inner desires which we cannot commit in our controlled civilization. So they are expressed instead through our art. I don't agree. I believe heaven and hell are one and the same. The soul belongs to heaven and the body to hell.
All right, welcome back to Conspiracy Theories and Unpopular Culture. I'm your host, Isaac Weishaupt. And today we're going to finish our analysis of the film, The House That Jack Built. This is the bonus. This is the one of the perks of being a supporter. You're going to get the second half of this show, which to me, this is a big deal, this film. The second half is going to get into the more esoteric elements of the alchemical journey that our killer Jack is going on. Previously we talked about, in part one, we talked about Lars von Trier, his background, and then we started going into the movie with the different murders, this guy embracing the shadow. Could it be Bill Gates? He's in Washington. I don't know. I don't know. And we recently, and the most recent murder was the hunting scene, which is very disturbing, of course. Now, let's just resume right there. He basically kills this woman and her kids, and then presumably starts killing crows. Okay, you see him pick up a crow, and then the next, you know, they do a little cut scene, and they show the, and I'll put these images on the Instagram for you. They show the crows laying in a formation, and then the bodies of the wife, or the woman and the kids. And this is a reference to earlier in the film. He was talking about how he didn't like hunters because of like how they had these trophy prize things, you know, how they always put it on display. Well, he was apparently lying, right? But more importantly, symbolically, the crow, you've heard me talk about this before, the crow is the representation of the first stage of alchemy, the blackening. This is where you wipe out everything, all the social constructs, so you can be reborn perfected. You can refill the cup with perfection. So it's appropriate that it's the crow. And then, of course, you got like Aleister Crowley, of course, maybe, right? But the alchemical process is what this is all about, this whole film. So he then is back, you know, the murder scene's over, and we're back to like this sort of disembodied dialogue that we can't really tell what's going on between him and Verge. And he's talking about how the cosmos affects him, which again, not to belabor the point, but this is alchemy, right? Like Thoth and Hermes, the hermetic axiom, as above, so below. The cosmos, what's going on out there in the stars and the skies and the universe, affects us here on Earth because everything's connected. Everything. And he talks about an eclipse arousing his aggression. And you've seen this in films like 2001 A Space Odyssey. The symbolism is representative of the process of the great work of alchemy, the marriage of the moon and the sun, the opposites, the polarities, the alchemical wedding. So it's just like over and over and over again. Now, here they show you the eclipse, and it appears as a black sun. Again, let's talk about, there's a book called The Black Sun of Alchemy by Stanton Marlin. And in the foreword, listen to this. Marlin writes about the shadow of the sun and its darkness. And where is this more apparent than the total eclipse of the moon? That big fake moon. Perhaps in our time, this represents the patriarchal sun king and its shadow, which eclipses the feminine. Whereas the black sun has no need to eclipse the moon because both have a soft glow, one from within and the other from outer reflection. So when you get into these, I don't know, schools of thought of the esoteric, like it's always like talking about this kind of stuff with the heavenly bodies and how it's like a reflection of what's going on here on Earth inside of men. And we've seen, if you watch the World of Worlds TV series, I did a show on that in, what, late 2020, I think. There was a lot of, there's a whole thing about this tattoo of the black sun on the aliens. Then we hear him talking about how he had to keep changing his material of the house because he's got OCD, right? And he's an architect, he's a mason. And he removes some cinder blocks because he needs to use the divine material. Again, same concept over and over. Rebuilding oneself to be divine. At this point, it's revealed his name as a killer is Mr. Sophistication. Oh my gosh, it's so loud out here. I'm very sorry. It's just hot. I got the window open. I'm dying. It's so hot. July, when I'm recording this. Anyway, my apologies. But I'm not turning the air conditioner up. No. That's what they want. That's what the Illuminati wants. They want me to turn the air up. So I'd rather just take my clothes off and sit here and sweat in the studio. It's fine. At this point, it's part of the process. I've been doing this so long. I can't change it now. What, am I going to get a polished Joe Rogan studio at this point? No. Absolutely not. Okay, so again, disembodied dialogue. He's talking to Verge. He's like, oh, I taste acid. Verge tells him that happens at this depth. And they're like, what is it? What are they talking about? Well, you find out later. Like I said in the first part, I will discuss this film as it unfolds as I saw it, okay? Then the next incident, he's actually got a girlfriend now. She's not bad looking. So, good job, buddy. But anyway, he's got a girlfriend, but he's like mean as hell to her. And I thought watching it, the way he was so mean to her, it's almost like he's pushing her away because he kind of loves her, but he knows he's going to hurt her. Right. And he kind of tells her like, look, I'm a killer. I killed 60 people. And then she's like, what? And he's like, I killed 61 people. And she's like, you just said 60. And he's like, well, that could change in 10 minutes. Like, implying he's going to kill her. And she's, like, still sticking around. And she eventually, like, runs out the door like, oh, my God, this guy's for real. He's going to kill me. And he runs out to the streets. There's a cop. Cop's in the car. She's like, hey, you got to help me. My boyfriend's crazy. He said he's killed 60 people. And he's like, have you been drinking? And she's like, well, yeah, but... And he's like, go inside. Cops. Oh, cops. I mean, this is a movie scene, right? But then homeboy comes downstairs and he's even like, he tells the guy, he's like, everything she told you is true. I'm a killer. And he's like, okay, both of you guys go back inside. So, and then he leaves. Which, to give cops credit, I don't think that's how cops would really react. But maybe, who knows? I've seen it in movies enough. Maybe it's true. They go back in. And he proceeds to take a magic marker to place circles around her breasts, like indicating he's going to cut her breasts off. And she's still like just kind of doing it, like going along with it. And he says, if you like screaming, I definitely think that you should. Oh my God. And she starts screaming. And then he sort of helps her and he starts screaming too. And he's like, see, no one's coming to help you. And then, you know, it happens. But, and by the way, I don't know if this is true or not, but I've always heard that, like, if you're in a situation where, you know, you're yelling help, fill in the blank, whatever situation that may be, you're better off yelling fire. I don't know if that's true. That seems crazy to me. If I heard someone screaming help, I'd probably go check it out, I would think, right? But, anyways, I forgot his girlfriend, he's calling her Simple. Like, that's how mean he is there. He's degrading. He makes her select the own knife with which he kills her with. He cuts her breasts off, puts one on the cop car under the windshield wiper. Because I guess the cop car's hanging out again now. And then he takes the other one and ends up making a wallet out of it. You know, this guy's like Ed Gein level crazy, right? Now, there's some elements to this. When do we want to talk about it? We'll talk about it in the conclusion. Just hold that thought. Now, there's going to be a clip here. There's going to be like two parts to this clip because it's kind of long. First, they're going to talk about how, you know, the Verge is talking to him, like, the implications that he's misogynistic. Then the second discussion, he's talking about how religion ruined people. Take a listen.
Why are they always so stupid?
Who's stupid?
All the women you kill strike me as seriously unintelligent.
Come on. I've also killed men.
But you only talk about the stupid women. Unless you think all women are stupid.
Well, the stories I've told were selected at random, but...
You feel superior to women and want to brag. It turns you on, doesn't it, Jake?
No. But women are easier, not physically. They're just easier to work with. More cooperative.
To kill, you mean?
If you like. Mr. Sophistication believes in that theory.
So, Mr. Sophistication is the theoretician.
I can tell you're lapping it up when I tell you about Mr. Sophistication. So, Jack hears voices that order him to do this or do that. Jack must be psychotic. I loathe diagnoses you can just write down in letters.
That's not fair. The letters are clear. They look after us and create boundaries between good and evil. And they carry religion.
Religion has ruined human beings. Because your God teaches people to deny the tiger in themselves. And turns us all into a throng of slaves. Too shameful to acknowledge it.
Oh, Jack, you should have read the right letters in your life. But you didn't want to.
So that's what this is all about. Right? It's about embracing alchemy as a great work, but also destroying the foothold religion has on the social constructs. He says God wants us to deny the tiger inside of us. Now, as far as the misogyny stuff, Lars, like I talked about in part one, he has a troubled past with women, apparently. So maybe this is some kind of confession. Maybe this is some kind of outlook into why he's such a jerk. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a Lars von Trier fan to that level that I know how to interpret that, but that's what people say. But the idea that God denies us the tiger inside is a very Church of Satan idea. That's why the Church of Satan hates Christianity. They officially don't worship Satan, quote unquote. But they want man to embrace the inner animal because, like the nine satanic statements says, the man is just an animal, just an evolved animal. That's it. And man should embrace his animalistic urges. Next clip, and this one's going to be real long. Finally they talk about it. The ideas that I've been kind of watching throughout this movie, they talk about good and evil. And he talks about creating art through reduction and imposing morality limits is kind of bad because art is much superior. So like you should never limit art to any extent. And and then he goes on and explains the process for making wine, which is like they call the noble rot. Take a listen, we'll come back.
The collection of corpses were mostly frozen shortly after death. However, I think a handful of them by chance had reached at least a certain degree of putrefaction before I managed to get them on ice. Can you say if putrefaction is good or evil? Most people would say it's the natural breakdown, which in the end is a reaction of matter, which is the basis for life on Earth, thereby it's neither particularly good nor evil, and that a human being must be perceived as alive if you're to describe that person's qualities and identify that person's ultimate goal. But this is where Mr. Sophistication has a very different opinion. He argues quite well that the ultimate goal for the human being is not prior to death, but after.
You reduce everything human to matter, and that way life disappears, and along with it, art, which you value so highly.
Verge, you're a bitter old bastard. You kill art by imposing your moral ruler on life, which I want to free, because art is so immeasurably vaster than we will ever understand. May I illustrate now?
There is no avoiding it, is there?
I don't have a handle on how many processes take part in the decay of a dead human, but I know a bit about dessert wines. In order to achieve the most sublime sweetness and the greatest wines, nature has provided us with various methods. The three most common forms of decomposition are frost, dehydration, and a fungus with the enticingly mysterious name, the noble rot. The first method is the one that in Germany is used to produce ice wine. The method quite simply entails leaving the grapes on the vine for so long that they are exposed to frost for a certain number of nights before they are pressed. This method increases the sugar content in the wine dramatically. It is very risky, as the grapes must have certain qualities in order to be able to withstand the process. On top of that, there can be uncertainty about whether or not the first night's frost lives up precisely to the expectations, etc. The second method is called Trockenbären, in which the grapes are allowed to hang on the vine until they dry up and very nearly become raisins. The last method, which for example is essential for the production of Sauternes, is a kind of mold that causes grapes to be very full-bodied and have an explosively high sugar content. You could say about all three processes that it's the breakdown that lifts the living grape up to be part of an artwork. You can view the processes that start in a human being after death in the same manner.
Says you, and I still say that without love there is no art. It's not up for debate. The thing you are talking about with the grapes is just nature's method of decomposing. If decomposition is a way to salvation, then what about your house? By God, you cannot convince me that the idea of your first house being torn down was in any way satisfying. Do you claim that it was built to be torn down?
No, of course, it wasn't ideal. And I'm sorry to say that it happened no less than three more times that I started construction and then became doubtful. It was difficult to create the house that I dreamed of. The material didn't do what I wanted it to do. The house as I had drawn it already, at very first detail, something banal, not to say ordinary, about them.
Isn't that what in art you'd call epigonism? Your great talent only reached so far. You, artist of all times.
When you were writing, didn't you yourself plan the destruction of your most popular literary work?
The Aeneid was a commissioned work where the ruling power and its ideas were glorified by me to the point where it was no longer art.
But if glorification could demean a work, why should destruction and demolition not be able to do the opposite and create art? Albert Speer invented the theory of ruin value by examining the Greek and Roman ruins and constructed his buildings using both weaker and stronger materials so that they, in 1,000 years, would appear as aesthetically perfect ruins.
Which, fortunately, were smashed to atoms in mere few years after their construction.
He talks about the natural breakdown of matter, the second law of thermodynamics, entropy, as it were, in science. And he says, look, like the natural breakdown of matter, it's not good, it's not evil. Which we've talked about in part one, all this Saturnian ideas of like, there's no such thing as good, there's no such thing as bad. They're all social constructs. And he has to embrace the evil to evolve, basically. And then he has like, he's got this weird philosophy of building and tearing down, explaining about, he's trying to design this house, but he keeps getting it destroyed and rebuilt. And the destruction is what creates the art, which reminded me of, I believe it's the Tibetan monks, how they do those beautiful sand mandalas on a table with different colors and such. And they take all this time to build this beautiful sand mandala, and then they just wipe it clean. You know, and there's like a lesson there. It's kind of like building a puzzle. Like, are you the kind of person that builds a puzzle and then like glues it together? Or are you the kind of person that can build a puzzle, admire it, admire the process, say, oh, this is beautiful, and then you just crumble it up, put it back in the box? Okay, that's kind of like the idea here, right? And, you know, I like that idea. I like that idea. Because you can't become attached to worldly things. Like, that's one thing I like about Buddhism. They really harp on that fact, and it's true. Like, the attachment brings the suffering. Everything's temporary. We're all on this journey, and, you know, that's why a lot of people always are like, "What, Isaac, why don't you get so upset reading all this stuff and talking about all this stuff?" And it's, well, I've got a deep ingrained idea in my head, dare I say a worldview or philosophy, and it's like, you know, you can't take this stuff with you. You can't let it ruin your day. I mean, like, sure, the elites are making a great reset, and, you know, the communism manifesto, one world Luciferian order is on its way. What, are you gonna make your life miserable for the next 5 years waiting to see if that happens, when that happens? You're gonna take that out on your family and be upset? Now you're a jerk to be around? No, don't do that. You know, you just arm yourself with the knowledge you need. You put up a little bit of knowledge of people at work. A little bit. You don't want to get chastised. They'll kick you out of there, trust me. But yeah, I don't know. Like, that's kind of like, to me, it's like, it's also very temporary. Why get wrapped around the axles? Just enjoy, like homeboy Ram Dass says, be here now. Live in the present. Live in the moment. Because we don't know for fact that all this is going to happen, all this bad stuff. For hundreds of years, they've been talking about the end of the world coming and how, you know, society's never been more awful. And, well, maybe. I mean, on one hand, like, to defend the other side of the argument, like, they say violent crimes are the lowest they've ever been. So what? So now we got to watch Lil Nas X, you know, kiss gay dudes on the stage in front of pagan symbolism? Okay. It's a fair trade. I'd take that over people getting robbed. I don't know. I have a weird viewpoint on it. I mean, you can talk me either side of this. It depends on what day you catch me, right? Anyhow, he talks about destruction creating art and ruined value. And ruined value, it's the idea, which, and I never heard of this before. I looked it up. They build something, and when the building falls apart, it'll leave some nice-looking remains. Isn't that interesting? And it's kind of weird because Jack this whole time is like doctoring up the bodies in the freezer. Like, eventually he starts like posing them, making them smile and stuff. Oh, it's creepy. And he's talking about how artists don't worry about what the humans, and I don't think this is in the clip, this is after. He talks about how artists shouldn't concern themselves with what other people think or what God wants. It's all about the artist's work and the art. He talks about, and he gets into some Nazi stuff, right? Which is curious because of Lars's previous Nazi comments. Talks about the Stuka planes, how they had, when they would nosedive, it had like this whistling. And they called it Jericho's trumpet. Terrifying. Terrifying. And he rightfully so tells us how evil creates the ultimate icons on Earth. We're talking about like Hitler, Stalin, Mao. And he argues they were all making art with dead bodies. Crazy, huh? And And it's like, is he wrong? Like, Hitler is a name. I would argue Hitler's more famous than damn near anybody. Not saying like he was a good dude. I mean, obviously not, right? But he's saying the evil creates the icons. Charles Manson. Everyone knows who Charles Manson is. Everyone knows who Hitler is. Why? Why do we know who they are? Why don't we know who, I don't know, someone who's a, I don't know, Mother Teresa? I don't know. People say she's Illuminate confirmed too. In passing, I've heard that. I don't know if that's true. Don't run with that. But anyway, he, okay, sticking to the film. Jack, he destroys and rebuilds the house. This is the alchemical process that he's going through. Right? That's what I, how I interpret it. The material didn't work the way they intended. He wants to rebuild it with the divine material. This is the alchemist. They take the material, you know, God made us in these bodies and it's all messed up. You got to strip it down. You got to distill it through the blackening, through the process. That's why we saw the crows earlier, because the alchemists talk about how there's the language of the birds, a higher consciousness. So they represent the stages with the birds. So anyway, so they keep talking. And Verge literally calls him the Antichrist, right on the nose. Then Jack is talking and he says that basically heaven and hell are the same. Your body's in hell, your spirit's in heaven, which is a very Gnostic idea, right? We're trapped in the material prison. Also, he's talking about these polarities of good and evil. Heaven and hell, they're the same. Good and evil, they're all the same. Nothing matters. And so this is the point where we find out he made a wallet out of, you know, the girl's other tit. He calls her Simple. But I even feel bad calling her Simple. Jeez, dude. And he makes a wallet out of it. We see the wallet, right? Now, this is, you want to know what kind of research I did? The only research I did on this movie, I Evolution of Horror, you know, it's a podcast I listen to. And I'm a Patreon supporter of them, by the way. Anyway, the host had a show talking about the house that Jack built. In fact, that's why I watched House That Jack Built, because he mentioned it a long time ago on a show, and I didn't want to plot spoil myself, so I turned off the podcast where he talks about the movie. So I went back and listened to it now that I've seen the movie. And the guest was talking about how Lars von Trier studies mythology. And in mythology, the Amazonian women would have their right tit cut off so they could be better at shooting arrows. But they would leave the left tit intact to nurse babies. And he alludes to the idea that Lars, being a student of mythology, this maybe could be an element of the movie. Maybe, right? They're pretty interesting, though. Interesting fun fact. So I gotta set this up. I just have like simple notes here, right? So we're getting close to the end now, and it seems like we're down to one more murder. And what he decides to do is recreate a Nazi method where they would take, they were limited on ammunition, so they would take like 5, 6, 7 people and sort of line them up so their heads were in alignment, so you could shoot one bullet. You'd only use one bullet to kill all these people. So he sets up the freezer with all these people, and they're like, you know, strapped into this thing, really, really messy. It's almost like Saw at this point. And he needs a full metal jacket bullet, so it goes through all the heads. In case you're not like a gun nerd, which I'm not. I'm not a gun dude. I like guns. I just like, I don't want to spend the money on them. Like, I'm just like, eh. I wasn't raised with guns. The first time I shot a gun was in the military. But it was fun. I remember it was a good time. And I'll probably buy a semi at some point here. I just have a, I got guns, but like what I want is a, because like to have fun on the range shooting at targets, I feel like a semi is probably the most fun, quote unquote fun. But I think guns are like, you know, very serious, right? Like I don't want to just guns haphazardly around the house and stuff. Like, I mean, they kill people, right? But anyway, the difference here, so like a Full Metal Jacket round, it doesn't expand after hitting a target, unlike a jacketed round or a hollow point or something, right? The cartridge case on a Full Metal Jacket is like, you know, I don't know, some kind of copper alloy, and then the bullet is lead. And again, with the alchemy, right? Like, lead is, Saturn is the symbol for lead in alchemy. And Saturn represents the blackening, which represents the first stage, which is the crow and all that, right? So he needs a Full Metal Jacket. Long story short, he goes to the gun store. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, so he needs a Full Metal Jacket. He's got his people strapped into this device he made. And the one guy, he was in the military, and he says, look, that's not a Full Metal Jacket. You just have a regular round right there. And he looks at it, and he's like, oh my God, they sold me the wrong ammunition. So he's like, oh, hang on, I'll be back. And he goes to the gun store, and is like, kind of being a dick. He's like, dude, you sold me the wrong round. And the guy's like being stupid, and he gets frustrated, and he leaves, and he goes to a trailer, which we've never met this character, but presumably this is the guy that really owns the gun store, and they have some kind of past, they know each other, and he's like, Jack's like, bro, I need a Full Metal Jacket. Why won't you, your guy's stupid, he won't sell it to me. And the guy, the gun store owner, like pulls a gun out on Jack, and he's like, hey, bro, we're on to you. And I got the police on the line. I'm going to call them, and they're going to arrest you. We know what you've been doing. And he's like, oh? He's like, we know you've been stealing. And which is bizarre, right? Like, you're like, he didn't steal anything. He was murdering. So I think on some levels, Jack's like relieved because he's like, oh, he doesn't know. So he plays along, and he just kind of sits in the couch like, okay, you got me. He's like, hey, look, you don't got to keep pointing that gun at me. And he sort of builds up, you know, because a good serial killer is good at, like, you know, faking empathy and faking the emotions. And the gun owner eventually gets more comfortable, and he gets a little too close to Jack. And, you know, Jack's got that shiv. And he stabs old boy in the dumb head. Grabs that Full Metal Jacket out of the dude's arsenal. And he goes back to the freezer room. Now, you'll notice, he puts on, the gun store owner was wearing a red hooded robe. Well, he puts that on. Where have you seen this before? Well, Eyes Wide Shut, of course, the red cloak. The red cloak. And how does that fit into this story? Well, red symbolizes blood, okay? That's why the cardinals in the Catholic Church wear the red robes. That's why in the Orthodox faith, they dye the eggs red for Pascha. It symbolizes the blood of Christ. But to these wackos, the red robes indicate the royal bloodline, the divine right to rule. It's the attitude of the elites and the masses, the tigers and the lambs, okay? Because that's their worldview. It's like, look, we were blessed by our God, Lucifer, or whoever, and we're supposed to control these mouth breathers. They're idiots. They're sheep. So he's in the freezer. He's got his rifle set up on a tripod. He wants to shoot the people with this Full Metal Jacket now. Now he's ready, but it's too close. And this whole time in the movie, in the freezer, there's a door that he can't open. He has no idea what's on the other side of this door. And he's like, I got to open this door so I can get the rifle far enough away so that I can shoot these people in the head. And he's like, I got to get this door open. How can I do it? And he grabs a pipe, an old cheater bar trick. I used to be an auto mechanic. That's what they call a cheater bar trick. You put the pipe on that handle, get some leverage, some torque. Bam, he gets that door open. Busts it open. And so he's got this red robe on. He goes in the secret compartment, the secret chamber. It's all dark. And boom, we hear the voice of Verge in there. He turns the light on, and guess who's sitting in the room? Verge. He appears to only be meeting him for the first time, which now confirms that the whole movie was Jack's recollection of the events to Verge. But we're now catching up to the scene of the narration, okay? So we find out that Verge has been with Jack the whole time also, though. It's very strange, because like Verge is like saying like how he was there at every murder. And that would imply that he's like a holy guardian angel. Crowley talked about how one needs to be in touch with their holy guardian angel all the time. To guide them, to guide the will, because they can facilitate the understanding of the will. So Verge, he talks to Jack, and he's talking to Jack about Jack's theory on material, how material can do its own work. And meanwhile, the cops are outside, and they're trying to break in. And Jack literally builds a house of corpses, a house of 1,000 corpses, on this, in the freezer, in the secret room. Like, that's the divine work or the divine material or something. I mean, it's real bizarre, right? Things start getting wacky at the end. And then there's a hole in the floor, so he escapes through the bottom of the floor before the cops can get in. And boom, end of scene. Next scene, the final act, it says Epilogue Catabasis, which I'm probably mispronouncing that. I looked it up because I didn't know what that was. It means going to the underworld and the mythology stories, which is what I always talk about, right? Going into the cave, going underground, all these things. It's always where the initiate goes for the transformation to happen. It simulates death so one can be reborn. So, and this is easily the coolest part of the movie, right? Jack and Verge, like visually, Jack and Verge, they go into the water in this cave, and they go through some kind of abyss, and there's bubbles, and this underwater cave, like a cenote in Mexico, and we're now seeing this catabasis is going into the underworld, and Verge is the one escorting Jack, like how Virgil escorted Dante through the circles of hell. In the Inferno. A very cool sequence. They show a painting, which turns out to be the ferryman of Hades escorting Jack. Again, I'm a very uncultured person. I had no idea. I snooped around to figure out what was what. So Verge, he is the hermit. He is the guide. And we'll revisit that in the conclusion. But let's finish the movie real quick, okay? It's very terrifying. They hear a lot of buzzing, and Jack's like, what is that noise? And like, they talk about, well, you know, like people try to localize hell, meaning like they try to say like, well, you know, hell's got to be here or there or whatever. And Verge says that hell is the collective sounds of suffering. Ooh, makes your skin crawl when you're watching this. You're like, dude, where do you come up with this stuff? And we figure out, like, the whole movie was Jack confessing to Virgil as Virgil guides him through hell. And we sort of get and it's very, like, sort of abstract, so, like, it's hard to explain the ending here. But he sort of is rewatching the farmers and the scythes, right? Remember we talked about that in the first part? And now he's like a boy in the house looking back out at the same fields. And we find out those fields where they were cutting the reeds with their Grim Reaper sickles there was called the Elysian Fields. Now, that's very curious because if you look up some of the background of this stuff, Virgil, the Roman poet, his work called Aeneid, the Elysian Fields are part of hell. But it's also known as Elysium, and Elysium is the place where the people in mythology, like, the gods would bless certain people with immortality. And they would send these people to Elysium, aka the Elysian Fields. So in some ways, Jack sees the perfection of man as a child. This is the Philosopher's Stone. This is a big moment. If I had some cool sound effects, I'd play it right here. The whole thing is about that. The symbolically, the Jack is trying to get to the Elysian Fields. He's trying to achieve the immortality through alchemy. So he gets to the bottom. Now he's definitely at the bottom. He's in the ninth circle of hell here, or the first, or whatever. And you see this lava flowing. Virgil tells him this is the deepest hell. This is actually not where you're going. He says you're actually going a couple circles up, but like I wanted to show this to you because I know you wanted to see everything. Meaning, this is a guy that wanted to see the darkest of dark. But Jack, he sees this bridge that's broken. And he says, what's over there on the other side? Virg tells him, well, it leads back out of hell. And it's the stairway to heaven, literally. But it's a broken bridge, so how do you do it? Well, you can climb the wall, but if you fall off this wall, then you're going to the deepest levels of hell. Into the lava you go. And you already know where this is headed, right? Jack rolls the dice. He's like, you know what? I'd rather go to the deepest levels of hell, because that's his MO. So he attempts it, and sure enough, he falls. And then, cue the credits. They play Hit the Road, Jack, for fun. Now, this is what we talked about the Stairway to Heaven in The Dark Path, right? I have a whole chapter on Led Zeppelin's Stairway to Heaven, which has like occult esoteric themes in it. And here, Verge is the hermit. He's the guide. He is just like the tarot card, right? Guiding the path of the initiate through self-exploration and the gnosis, the wisdom, the knowledge. And wouldn't you know it, Led Zeppelin's artwork, the infamous artwork for Led Zeppelin, has the hermit as the guide. So in some ways, you got a bit of a homage to Led Zeppelin in there. I mean, the lyrics of Stairway to Heaven are like kind of in the movie, right? Like they talk about two paths you can go by, but in the long run, there's still time to change the road you're on. Do you want the left-hand path or the right-hand path? They talk about shadows taller than the soul. Again, a reference to the shadow, which is what exactly Jack was talking about with the street lamps. And the whole idea there is that exploring the abyss is the key to enlightenment. Understanding the shadow. Understanding the darkness. And in the song, they talk about everything still turns to gold. Again, an alchemical reference. And then you go deep into the occult stuff, and Stairway to Heaven is an actual occult practice. Ascending the chakra points, traversing the Kabbalistic Tree of Life. Depicted in the Egyptian pyramid text, and the Chinese call it the walking on seven stars of the Big Dipper. It's a deep subject, and Peter Levine wrote a whole book called The Dark Lord, where he talks about a lot of those ideas. So in conclusion, what was this movie about? Well, it's about a couple things. We got the serial killers, we got the alchemy, we got the evil, and then how those things intertwine. And here's an observation I have that I don't have a good answer for. Maybe you smart people could figure it out. You'll notice the first killing starts with strangulation. He takes the breath away from the woman. And then as a child, he there's a very formative moment in those fields, in the Elysian Fields, where he was focused on the breath of the farmers. I don't think we talked about that, but that was a thing. Like there was like a bunch of them in a row, and they would pull the scythe back and inhale, move the scythe to cut the reeds, and exhale, all in rhythm. Hoot, 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 like that, right? And then at a certain point, he talks about the Iceman, the killer of the Iceman, about how he used to take the last breath of his victims. So there's like a breath connection here. Like, is it a commentary on breath as an indicator of life? Where maybe there's a cyclical nature of giving and taking, controlling, you know, a rhythm. Starting, finishing, the polarities. Maybe that's what it is. And speaking of the polarities, We can't ignore the big alchemical pursuit here, right? Well, his girlfriend, Simple, her real name is Jacqueline. Well, that must be on purpose, because you've got Jack and you've got Jacqueline. There's a reconciliation of the opposing forces, just like the film shows us. Because in alchemy, they believe in a balance of the masculine and the feminine. That's what the Baphomet is. It's the male goat with the breasts. And there's something about... And look, everyone's born with elements of both. Male and female. You know, hormonally or whatever you want to call it. Like, everyone's got estrogen and testosterone. The ratios of them are obviously quite different. But, like, that's what a lot of these people say. You know, people get all wrapped around the axles about gender. Like, oh, what? How can you feel like you're a woman or whatever? And it's like, well, we're all a bit of both, to be honest. Like, it's almost like race. Like, that's a construct. There's no such thing as race. There's nothing that, like, I mean, there's signifiers of being biologically male, obviously, right? But, like, it's a spectrum, really. Like, what about a hermaphrodite? They got both genitalia. You know what I'm saying? So we can't get too hung around the axles. There's people that fall in there's a minority of people that fall into this sort of thing where it's not crystal clear to them. That's why I always am like very, I don't know, what's the right term for that? Very sensitive to when we talk about these kinds of things. Because it's like, look, this is this is real. Like, people feel this way. Like, we're not so different. Like, they want to divide us so they can conquer us. They want us to focus on our differences and be like, well, you're a different race, you're a different gender, or you're not this gender enough, you're not this race enough. And it's like, none of this is real. None of it's real. This is all a construct, all of it. Everything we know, everything we talk about, everything's been told to you, the rules have been planted into your brain. From who? And how do those people know the truth? Anyway, we could go on about that all day, right? But yeah, you got Jack and Jacqueline. Again, Lars knew. He knows this stuff. Come on. Why do you think that was the thing? Jack and Jacqueline. Of course, and then we have the Elysian Fields, where the immortals went after achieving their great work. And Jack, he was never building a house, a literal house. Same as the Masons. They're figuratively building a perfected being, spiritual immortality through the wisdom. And the wisdom is that good and evil are constructs. This is where there's some overlap between my worldview and the occult worldview. Because it's true, like, good and evil, they are constructs. But, like, we can all agree that, like, murder's bad. Okay. Or murder should not be done. But some of these left-hand pathers say, well, you approach that darkness and you don't be afraid and you embrace them. You embrace the shadow. And it's the masses, the mouth breathers, the peasants that don't understand this and they're scared. And they never do it. But not Jack. Jack has elements of evil, I would argue. And this film is a lot about the antinomian rejection of society, basically like going against all social constructs. Because, like, truly society is here to instill the constructs and the rules that man must adhere to. Some people don't like that. I don't like that. Some people disagree with it. But the further you go from the social construct, the more of a price you pay, the more ostracized you are. Now, William Blake, his poems are emphasized in this film. And William Blake, interestingly enough, albeit a Christian, there was this weird time period where people were Christian, but they were also like anti-Christian at the same time. It's kind of weird. Because it was during the Enlightenment, there was all these ideas espoused by Adam Weishaupt, the Illuminati founder there, right? And what was going on during the Enlightenment, they decided, look, science should be the, and rationality should be the truth, big T. Because at the time, the church had too much of a grip. The church and the royals told everyone what the rules were, what the truth was, how they should act. And around the, there was this time of flux where they were like, no, science tells us the truth. Because the church is like, look, the earth is the center of the solar system. Shut up. And then Galileo was like, no, it's actually not. And, you know, he paid the price for that. And then eventually the church was like, okay, he was right. Okay. But there was a whole, this enlightenment fueled this massive, massive change of ideals. And William Blake and Adam Weishaupt and all these folks, they were all about equality. They were like, look, F these royals, F this church. Everyone's equal. Don't let them tell you who's better than another. Which is ironic because Jack seems to hate women, but he asserts that he killed men just as much as women because Verge has a conversation with him about this. He says, why you only talk about the women? You hate women? He's like, no, I hate men too. I killed them too. He's like, well, you're only telling me about the women. Which I don't understand because Verge was at the murders. Anyway. Well, William Blake, it turns out, was also visited by a holy guardian angel. He called them the Archangels. And Blake influenced the Beat Movement, which, oddly enough, ties us into Bob Dylan with the, you know, remember in the first part we talked about the cards from the NXS video? How Bob Dylan did it first? And now Jack's doing it? But The Tiger and the Lamb is the William Blake poem they constantly talk about, and the Lamb, of course, a reference to Christ and Christians. But they were opposing polarities, asking, why would God create good and evil? Well, it's because they're both necessary to achieve gnosis. Only the sheep, the mouth breathers, they don't know this. They don't get it. And Blake wrote a piece called Marriage of Heaven and Hell, where he depicts Satan as a symbol of creativity who needs freed from the oppression of God. So there you go. We always talk about creativity and art and the darkness. Well, there's another person that supports that idea. And I read in Lords of the Left-Hand Path, this book, says that Blake, William Blake and Milton, they were both the roots of the Process Church. And here we go into Manson. Manson was allegedly a part of the Process Church. And, you know, serial killers in general. So in some ways, maybe that's like a very veiled reference to that. Maybe. And finally, the ending. What's up with that ending? It's almost like Jack doesn't quite make it. Like he goes into the abyss to find the immortality. But he doesn't make it. He loses himself forever in the abyss. The bottom of hell. Warning, folks, that this is a very treacherous path. It's very dangerous. You might get immortality, but you might also be in the lowest rings of hell. You might be in the lava. So that's it. That's the movie. Lots of film critics say that there's like a ton of Lars's personal life in this film. Maybe. I don't know. To me, I clearly see alchemical ideas. I clearly see the antinomian practice of the rituals of the occult and embracing evil. But look, I watched this one time. I'm sure there's actually a ton more in this movie. I'll probably watch it again. It was actually really good, but man, is it disturbing in parts. But yeah, crazy film. By far one of the most wildest journeys I've been on. Very impactful. So there you go. Is it good? That's a social construct, my friend. You tell me. Is it good? Boy. It's a glimpse of evil, I know that. Anyways, thank you for your support. Thank you for being on the supporter feeds. I don't know if you're on the Rockfin, if you're listening to it on the VIP section, or if you're on my Patreon. I like your support any way I can get it. I appreciate you. If there's any images you're curious about, I'm going to post them on my Instagram, at Isaac Weishaupt. Like and subscribe. Links are always in the show notes. And until next time, stay woke.